The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner, continued, Cassette 4, Side 1. Free competition means nothing else than that everyone can present himself, assert himself, fight against another. Of course, the feudal party set itself against this, as its existence depended on an absence of competition. The contests in the time of the Restoration in France had no other substance than this, that the bourgeoisie was struggling for free competition, and the feudalists were seeking to bring back the guild system. Now, free competition has won, and against the guild system, it had to win. See below for the further discussion. If the revolution ended in a reaction, this only showed what the revolution really was. For every effort arrives at reaction when it comes to discrete reflection and storms forward in the original action only so long as it is an intoxication, an indiscretion. Discretion will always be the cue of the reaction, because discretion sets limits and liberates what was really wanted, that is, the principle, from the initial unbridledness and unrestrainedness. Wild young fellows, bumptious students, who set aside all considerations, are really Philistines, since with them, as with the latter, considerations form the substance of their conduct. Only that as swaggerers they are mutinous against considerations and in negative relations to them, but as Philistines, later, they give themselves up to considerations and have positive relations to them. In both cases, all their doing and thinking turns upon considerations. But the Philistine is reactionary in relation to the student. He is the wild fellow come to discreet reflection, as the latter is the unreflecting Philistine. Daily experience confirms the truth of this transformation and shows how the swaggerers turn to Philistines in turning gray. So, too, the so-called reaction in Germany gives proof that it was only the discreet continuation of the warlike jubilation of liberty. The revolution was not directed against the established, but against the establishment in question, against a particular establishment. It did away with this ruler, not with the ruler. On the contrary, the French were ruled most inexorably. It killed the old vicious rulers, but wanted to confer on the virtuous ones a securely established position. That is, it simply set virtue in the place of vice. Vice and virtue, again, are on their part distinguished from each other only as a wild young fellow from a Philistine. To this day, the revolutionary principle has gone no farther than to assail only one or another particular establishment, to be reformatory. Much as may be improved, strongly as discreet progress may be adhered to, always there is only a new master set in the old one's place. And the overturning is a building up. We are still at the distinction of the young Philistine from the old one. The revolution began in bourgeois fashion with the uprising of the third estate, the middle class. In bourgeois fashion, it dries away. It was not the individual man, and he alone is man, that became free, but the citizen, the citoyen, the political man, who, for that very reason, is not man with a capital M, but a specimen of the human species, and more particularly, a specimen of the species citizen, a free citizen. In the revolution, it was not the individual who acted so as to affect the world's history, but a people. The nation, the sovereign nation, wanted to effect everything. A fancied I, an idea, such as the nation is, appears acting. The individuals contribute themselves as tools of this idea and act as citizens. The commonalty has its power, and at the same time its limits, in the fundamental law of the state, in a charter, in a legitimate or just prince, who himself is guided and rules according to rational laws, in short, in legality. The period of the bourgeoisie is ruled by the British spirit of legality. An assembly of provincial estates is ever recalling that its authorization goes only so and so far, and that it is called at all only through favor, and can be thrown out again through disfavor. It is always reminding itself of its vocation. It is certainly not to be denied that my father begot me, but now that I am once begotten, surely his purposes in begetting do not concern me a bit. And whatever he may have called me to, I do what I myself will. Therefore, even a called assembly of estates, the French assembly in the beginning of the revolution, recognized quite rightly that it was independent of the caller. It existed, and would have been stupid if it did not avail itself of the right of existence, but fancied itself dependent as on a father. The called one no longer has to ask, what did the caller want when he created me? But what do I want after I have once followed the call? Not the caller, not the constituents, not the charter according to which their meeting was called out. Nothing will be to him a sacred, inviolable power. He is authorized for everything that is in his power. He will know no restrictive authorization, will not want to be loyal. This, if any such thing could be expected from chambers at all, would give a completely egoistic chamber, severed from all navel string and without consideration. But chambers are always devout, and therefore one cannot be surprised if so much halfway or undecided, that is, hypocritical egoism, parades in them. The members of the estates are to remain within the limits that are traced for them by the charter, by the king's will, and the like. If they will not or cannot do that, then they are to step out. What dutiful man could act otherwise, could put himself, his conviction, and his will as the first thing? Who could be so immoral as to want to assert himself, even if the body corporate and everything should go to ruin over it? People keep carefully within the limits of their authorization. Of course, one must remain within the limits of his power anyhow, because no one can do more than he can. My power, or, if it be so, powerlessness, be my sole limit, but authorization only restraining precepts? Should I profess this all-subversive view? No, I am a law-abiding citizen. The commonalty professes a morality which is most closely connected with its essence. The first demand of this morality is to the effect that one should carry on a solid business, an honorable trade, lead a moral life. Immoral to it is the sharper, the demirep, the thief, robber, and murderer, the gamester, the penniless man without a situation, the frivolous man. The doughty commoner designates the feeling against these immoral people as his deepest indignation. All these lack settlement, the solid quality of business, a solid, seemly life, a fixed income, etc. In short, they belong, because their existence does not rest on a secure basis, to the dangerous individuals or isolated persons, to the dangerous proletariat. They are individual ballers who offer no guarantee and have nothing to lose, and so nothing to risk. The forming of family ties binds a man. He who is bound furnishes security, can be taken hold of. Not so the streetwalker. The gamester stakes everything on the game, ruins himself and others, no guarantee. All who appear to the commoner suspicious, hostile, and dangerous might be comprised under the name vagabonds. Every vagabondish way of living displeases him. For there are intellectual vagabonds, too, to whom the hereditary dwelling place of their fathers seems too cramped and oppressive for them to be willing to satisfy themselves with the limited space any more. Instead of keeping within the limits of a temperate style of thinking, and taking as inviolable truth what furnishes comfort and tranquility to thousands, they overlap all bounds of the traditional, and run wild with their impudent criticism and untamed mania for doubt, these extravagating vagabonds. They form the class of the unstable, restless, changeable, of the proletariat, and if they give voice to their unsettled nature, they are called unruly fellows. Such a broad sense has the so-called proletariat, or pauperism. How much one would err if one believed the commonalty to be desirous of doing away with poverty, pauperism, to the best of its ability. On the contrary, the good citizen helps himself with the incomparably comforting conviction that the fact is that the good things of fortune are unequally divided and will always remain so, according to God's wise decree. The poverty which surrounds him in every alley does not disturb the true commoner further than that, at most, he clears his account with it by throwing an alms, or finds work and food for an honest and serviceable fellow. But so much the more does he feel his quiet enjoyment clouded by innovating and discontented poverty, by those poor who no longer behave quietly and endure, but begin to run wild and become restless. Lock up the vagabond, thrust the breeder of unrest into the darkest dungeon. He wants to arouse dissatisfaction and incite people against existing institutions in the state. Stone him! Stone him! But from these identical discontented ones comes a reasoning somewhat as follows. It need not make any difference to the good citizens who protects them and their principles, whether an absolute king or a constitutional one, a republic, if only they are protected. And what is their principle, whose protector they always love? Not that of labor, not that of birth either, but that of mediocrity, of the golden mean, a little birth and a little labor, that is, an interest-bearing possession. Possession is here the fixed, the given, inherited, birth. Interest drawing is the exertion about it, labor, laboring capital, therefore. Only no immoderation, no ultra, no radicalism. Right of birth, certainly, but only hereditary possessions. Labor, certainly, yet little or none at all of one's own, but labor of capital and of the subject laborers. If an age is imbued with an error, some always derive advantage from the error, while the rest have to suffer from it. In the Middle Ages, the error was general among Christians that the Church must have all power, or the supreme lordship on earth. The hierarchs believed in this truth not less than the laymen, and both were spellbound in the like error. But by it, the hierarchs had the advantage of power. The laymen had to suffer subjection. However, as the saying goes, one learns wisdom by suffering. And so the laymen at last learned wisdom and no longer believed in the medieval truth. A like relation exists between the commonalty and the laboring class. Commoner and laborer believe in the truth of money. They who do not possess it believe in it no less than those who possess it. The laymen, therefore, as well as the priests. Money governs the world is the keynote of the civic epoch. A destitute aristocrat and a destitute laborer, as starvelings, amount to nothing so far as political consideration is concerned. Birth and labor do not do it, but money brings consideration. The possessors rule, but the state trains up from the destitute its servants, to whom, in proportion as they are to rule, govern in its name, it gives money, a salary. I receive everything from the state. Have I anything without the state's assent? What I have without this, it takes from me as soon as it discovers the lack of a legal title. Do I not, therefore, have everything through its grace, its assent? On this alone, on the legal title, the commonalty rests. The commoner is what he is through the protection of the state, through the state's grace. He would necessarily be afraid of losing everything if the state's power were broken. But how is it with him who has nothing to lose? How with the proletarian? As he has nothing to lose, he does not need the protection of the state for his nothing. He may gain, on the contrary, if that protection of the state is withdrawn from the protégé. Therefore, the non-possessor will regard the state as a power protecting the possessor, which privileges the latter but does nothing for him, the non-possessor, but to suck his blood. The state is a commoner's state, is the estate of the commonalty. It protects man not according to his labor, but according to his tractableness, loyalty, to wit, according to whether the rights entrusted to him by the state are enjoyed and managed in accordance with the will, that is, laws of the state. Under the regime of the commonalty, the laborers always fall into the hands of the possessors, of those who have at their disposal some bit of the state domains, and everything possessable in state domain belongs to the state, and is only a fief of the individual, especially money and land, of the capitalists, therefore. The laborer cannot realize on his labor to the extent of the value that it has for the consumer. Labor is badly paid. The capitalist has the greatest profit from it. Well paid, and more than well paid, are only the labors of those who heighten the splendor and dominion of the state, the labors of high state servants. The state pays well that its good citizens, the possessors, may be able to pay badly without danger. It secures to itself by good payment its servants, out of whom it forms a protecting power, a police. To the police belong soldiers, officials of all kinds, those of justice, education, etc., in short, the whole machinery of the state, for the good citizens, and the good citizens gladly pay high tax rates to it in order to pay so much lower rates to their laborers. But the class of laborers, because unprotected in what they essentially are, for they do not enjoy the protection of the state as laborers, but as its subjects, they have a share in the enjoyment of the police, a so-called protection of the law, remains a power hostile to this state of possessors, this citizen kingship. Its principle, labor, is not recognized as to its value. It is exploited, a spoil of the possessors, the enemy. The laborers have the most enormous power in their hands, and if they once became thoroughly conscious of it and used it, nothing would withstand them. They would only have to stop labor, regard the product of labor as theirs, and enjoy it. This is the sense of the labor disturbances which show themselves here and there. The state rests on the slavery of labor. If labor becomes free, the state is lost. 2. Social liberalism. We are free-born men, and wherever we look, we see ourselves made servants of egoists. Are we therefore to become egoists too? Heaven forbid. We want rather to make egoists impossible. We want to make them all ragamuffins. All of us must have nothing that all may have. So say the socialists. Who is this person that you call all? It is society. But is it corporeal then? We are its body. You? Why, you are not a body yourselves. You, sir, are corporeal, to be sure. You too, and you. But you all together are only bodies, not a body. Accordingly, the United Society may indeed have bodies at its service, but no one body of its own. Like the nation of the politicians, it will turn out to be nothing but a spirit, its body only semblance. The freedom of man is, in political liberalism, freedom from persons, from personal dominion, from the master, the securing of each individual person against other persons, personal freedom. No one has any orders to give. The law alone gives orders. But even if the persons have become equal, yet their possessions have not. And yet the poor man needs the rich the poor, the former the rich man's money, the latter the poor man's labor. So no one needs another as a person, but needs him as a giver, and thus as one who has something to give, as holder or possessor. So what he has makes the man. And in having, or in possessions, people are unequal. Consequently, social liberalism concludes, no one must have, as according to political liberalism, no one was to give orders. As in that case, the state alone obtained the command, so now society alone obtains the possessions. For the state, protecting each one's person and property against the other separates them from one another. Each one is his special part and has his special part. He who is satisfied with what he is and has finds this state of things profitable. But he who would like to be and have more looks around for this more and finds it in the power of other persons. Here he comes upon a contradiction. As a person, no one is inferior to another, and yet one person has what another has not but would like to have. So, he concludes, the one person is more than the other after all, for the former has what he needs, the latter has not. The former is a rich man, the latter a poor man. He now asks himself further, are we to let what we rightly buried come to life again? Are we to let this circuitously restored inequality of persons pass? No. On the contrary, we must bring quite to an end what was only half accomplished. Our freedom from another's person still lacks the freedom from what the other person can command, from what he has in his personal power, in short, from personal property. Let us then do away with personal property. Let no one have anything any longer. Let everyone be a ragamuffin. Let property be impersonal. Let it belong to society. Before the supreme ruler, the sole commander, we had all become equal, equal persons, that is, nullities. Before the supreme proprietor, we all become equal, ragamuffins. For the present, one is still in another's estimation a ragamuffin, a have-nothing. But then, this estimation ceases. We are all ragamuffins together, and as the aggregate of communistic society, we might call ourselves a ragamuffin crew. When the proletarian shall really have founded his proposed society in which the interval between rich and poor is to be removed, then he will be a ragamuffin. For then he will feel that it amounts to something to be a ragamuffin, and might lift ragamuffin to be an honorable form of address, just as the revolution did with the word citizen. Ragamuffin is his ideal. We are all to become ragamuffins. This is the second robbery of the personal in the interest of humanity. Neither command nor property is left to the individual. The state took the former, society the latter. Because in society the most oppressive evils make themselves felt, therefore the oppressed especially, and consequently the members of the lower regions of society, think they found the fault in society, and make it their task to discover the right society. This is only the old phenomenon that one looks for the fault first in everything but himself, and consequently in the state, in the self-seeking of the rich, and so on, which yet have precisely our fault to thank for their existence. The reflections and conclusions of communism look very simple. As matters lie at this time, in the present situation with regard to the state, therefore, some, and they the majority, are at a disadvantage compared to others, the minority. In this state of things, the former are in a state of prosperity, the latter in a state of need. Hence, the present state of things, the state itself, must be done away with. And what in its place? Instead of the isolated state of prosperity, a general state of prosperity, a prosperity of all. Through the revolution, the bourgeoisie became omnipotent, and all inequality was abolished by everyone's being raised or degraded to the dignity of a citizen. The common man raised, the aristocrat degraded. The third estate became sole estate, namely, the estate of citizens of the state. Now communism responds, our dignity and our essence consist not in our being all the equal children of our mother, the state, all born with equal claim to her love and her protection, but in our all existing for each other. This is our equality, or herein we are equal, in that we, I as well as you, and you and all of you, are active or labor, each one for the rest, in that each of us is a laborer then. The point for us is not what we are for the state, citizens, not our citizenship, therefore, but what we are for each other, that each of us exists only through the other, who, caring for my wants, at the same time sees his own satisfied by me. He labors for my clothing, tailor, I for his need of amusement, comedy writer, rope dancer, he for my food, farmer, I for his instruction, scientist. It is labor that constitutes our dignity and our equality. What advantage does citizenship bring us? Burdens. And how high is our labor appraised? As low as possible. But labor is our sole value all the same. That we are laborers is the best thing about us. This is our significance in the world, and therefore it must be our consideration too, and must come to receive consideration. What can you meet us with? Surely nothing but labor too. Only for labor or services do we owe you a recompense, not for your bare existence, not for what you are for yourselves either, but only for what you are for us. By what have you claims on us? Perhaps by your high birth? No. Only by what you do for us that is desirable or useful. Be it thus then. We are willing to be worth to you only so much as we do for you, but you are to be held likewise by us. Services determine value, those services that are worth something to us, and consequently labors for each other, labors for the common good. Let each one be in the other's eyes a laborer. He who accomplishes something useful is inferior to none, or all laborers, laborers of course in the sense of laborers for the common good, that is, communistic laborers, are equal. But as the laborer is worth his wages, let the wages too be equal. As long as faith sufficed for man's honor and dignity, no labor, however harassing, could be objected to if it only did not hinder a man in his faith. Now, on the contrary, when everyone is to cultivate himself into man, condemning a man to machine-like labor amounts to the same thing as slavery. If a factory worker must tire himself to death 12 hours and more, he is cut off from becoming man. Every labor is to have the intent that the man be satisfied. Therefore, he must become a master in it too, be able to perform it as a totality. He who, in a pin factory, only puts on the heads, only draws the wire, works, as it were, mechanically, like a machine. He remains half-trained, does not become a master. His labor cannot satisfy him. It can only fatigue him. His labor is nothing by itself, has no object in itself, is nothing complete in itself. He labors only into another's hands and is used, exploited, by this other. For this laborer in another's service, there is no enjoyment of a cultivated mind, at most, crude amusements. Culture, you see, is barred against him. To be a good Christian, one needs only to believe, and that can be done under the most oppressive circumstances. Hence, the Christian-minded take care only of the oppressed laborer's piety, their patience, submission, etc. Only so long as the downtrodden classes were Christians could they bear all their misery, for Christianity does not let their murmurings and exasperation rise. Now the hushing of desires is no longer enough, but their sating is demanded. The bourgeoisie has proclaimed the gospel of the enjoyment of the world, of material enjoyment, and now wonders that this doctrine finds adherence among us poor. It has shown that not faith and poverty, but culture and possessions make a man blessed. We proletarians understand that too. The commonalty freed us from the orders and arbitrariness of individuals, but that arbitrariness was left which springs from the conjuncture of situations and may be called the fortuity of circumstances. Favoring fortune and those favored by fortune still remain. When, for example, a branch of industry is ruined and thousands of laborers become breadless, people think reasonably enough to acknowledge that it is not the individual who must bear the blame, but that the evil lies in the situation. Let us change the situation then, but let us change it thoroughly, and so that its fortuity becomes powerless and a law. Let us no longer be slaves of chance. Let us create a new order that makes an end of fluctuations. Let this order, then, be sacred. Formerly, one had to suit the lords to come to anything. After the revolution, the word was grasp fortune. Luck hunting or hazard playing, civil life was absorbed in this. Then, alongside this, the demand that he who has obtained something shall not frivolously stake it again. Strange and yet supremely natural contradiction. Competition, in which alone civil or political life unrolls itself, is a game of luck through and through. From the speculations of the exchange down to the solicitation of offices, the hunt for customers, looking for work, aspiring to promotion and decorations, the second-hand dealers, petty haggling, etc. If one succeeds in supplanting and outbidding his rivals, then the lucky throw is made. For it must be taken as a piece of luck to begin with that the victor sees himself equipped with an ability, even though it has been developed by the most careful industry, against which the others do not know how to rise. Consequently, that no abler ones are found. And now those who ply their daily lives in the midst of these changes of fortune without seeing any harm in it are seized with the most virtuous indignation when their own principle appears in naked form and breeds misfortune as hazard playing. Hazard playing, you see, is too clear, too barefaced a competition, and like every decided nakedness, offends honorable modesty. The socialists want to put a stop to this activity of chance and to form a society in which men are no longer dependent on fortune, but free. In the most natural way in the world, this endeavor first utters itself as hatred of the unfortunate against the fortunate, of those for whom fortune has done little or nothing against those for whom it has done everything. But properly, the ill feeling is not directed against the fortunate, but against fortune, this rotten spot of the commonalty. As the communists first declare free activity to be man's essence, they, like all workday dispositions, need a Sunday. Like all material endeavors, they need a God, an uplifting and edification alongside their witless labor. That the communist sees in you the man, the brother, is only the Sunday side of communism. According to the workday side, he does not by any means take you as man simply, but as human laborer or laboring man. The first view has in it the liberal principle. In the second, illiberality is concealed. If you were a lazybones, he would not indeed fail to recognize the man in you, but would endeavor to cleanse him as a lazy man from laziness, and to convert you to the faith that labor is man's destiny and calling. Therefore, he shows a double face. With the one, he takes heed that the spiritual man be satisfied. With the other, he looks about him for means for the material or corporeal man. He gives man a twofold post, an office of material acquisition and one of spiritual. The commonalty had thrown open spiritual and material goods and left it with each one to reach out for them if he liked. Communism really procures them for each one, presses them upon him, and compels him to acquire them. It takes seriously the idea that because only spiritual and material goods make us men, we must unquestionably acquire these goods in order to be man. The commonalty made acquisition free. Communism compels to acquisition and recognizes only the acquirer, him who practices a trade. It is not enough that the trade is free, but you must take it up. So all that is left for criticism to do is to prove that the acquisition of these goods does not yet by any means make us men. With the liberal commandment that everyone is to make a man of himself, or everyone to make himself man, there was posited the necessity that everyone must gain time for this labor of humanization, that is, that it should become possible for everyone to labor on himself. The commonalty thought it had brought this about if it handed over everything human to competition, but gave the individual a right to every human thing. Each may strive after everything. Social liberalism finds that the matter is not settled with the may, because may means only if it is forbidden to none, but not it is made possible to everyone. Hence, it affirms that the commonalty is liberal only with the mouth and in words, supremely illiberal in act. It, on its part, wants to give all of us the means to be able to labor on ourselves. By the principle of labor, that of fortune or competition is certainly outdone. But at the same time, the laborer, in his consciousness that the essential thing in him is the laborer, holds himself aloof from egoism and subjects himself to the supremacy of a society of laborers, as the commoner clung with self-abandonment to the competition state. The beautiful dream of a social duty still continues to be dreamed. People think again that society gives what we need, and we are under obligations to it on that account, owe it everything. They are still at the point of wanting to serve a supreme giver of all good. That society is no ego at all, which could give, bestow, or grant, but an instrument or means from which we may derive benefit. That we have no social duties, but solely interests, for the pursuance of which society must serve us. That we owe society no sacrifice, but if we sacrifice anything, sacrifice it to ourselves. Of this, the socialists do not think. Because they, as liberals, are imprisoned in the religious principle and zealously aspire after a sacred society, such as the state was hitherto. Society, from which we have everything, is a new master, a new spook, a new supreme being, which takes us into its service and allegiance. The more precise appreciation of political as well as social liberalism must wait to find its place further on. For the present, we pass this over, in order first to summon them before the tribunal of humane, or critical, liberalism. 3. Humane Liberalism. As liberalism is completed in self-criticizing critical liberalism, in which the critic remains a liberal and does not go beyond the principle of liberalism, man with a capital M, this may distinctively be named after man and called the humane. The laborer is counted as the most material and egoistical man. He does nothing at all for humanity, does everything for himself, for his welfare. The commonalty, because it proclaimed the freedom of man, with a capital M, only as to his birth, had to leave him in the claws of the unhuman man, the egoist, for the rest of life. Hence, under the regime of political liberalism, egoism has an immense field for free utilization. The laborer will utilize society for his egoistic ends, as the commoner does the state. You have only an egoistic end after all. Your welfare, is the humane liberal's reproach to the socialist. Take up a purely human interest, then I will be your companion. But to this there belongs a consciousness stronger, more comprehensive than a laborer consciousness. The laborer makes nothing, therefore he has nothing. But he makes nothing because his labor is always a labor that remains individual, calculated strictly for his own want, a labor day by day. In opposition to this, one might, for instance, consider the fact that Gutenberg's labor did not remain individual, but begot innumerable children and still lives today. It was calculated for the want of humanity and was an eternal, imperishable labor. The humane consciousness despises the commoner consciousness as well as the laborer consciousness. For the commoner is indignant only at vagabonds, at all who have no definite occupation, and their immorality. The laborer is disgusted by the idler, lazybones, and his immoral, because parasitic and unsocial principles. To this, the humane liberal retorts, the unsettledness of many is only your product, Philistine, but that you, proletarian, demand the grind of all and want to make drudgery general is a part still clinging to you of your pack mule life up to this time. Certainly, you want to lighten drudgery itself by all having to drudge equally hard, yet only for this reason, that all may gain leisure to an equal extent. But what are they to do with their leisure? What does your society do that this leisure may be passed humanly? It must leave the gained leisure to egoistic preference again, and the very gain that your society furthers falls to the egoist, as the gain of the commonalty, the masterlessness of man, could not be filled with a human element by the state, and therefore was left to arbitrary choice. It is assuredly necessary that man be masterless, but therefore the egoist is not to become master over man again either, but man over the egoist. Man must assuredly find leisure, but if the egoist makes use of it, it will be lost for man. Therefore, you ought to have given leisure a human significance. But you laborers undertake even your labor from an egoistic impulse, because you want to eat, drink, live. How should you be less egoists in leisure? You labor only because having your time to yourselves, idling, goes well after work done, and what you are to while away your leisure time with is left to chance. But if every door is to be bolted against egoism, it would be necessary to strive after completely disinterested action, total disinterestedness. This alone is human, because only man, with a capital M, is disinterested, the egoist always interested. If we let disinterestedness pass unchallenged for a while, then we ask, do you mean not to take an interest in anything, not to be enthusiastic for anything, not for liberty, humanity, etc.? Oh, yes, but that is not an egoistic interest, not interestedness, but a human, a theoretical interest, to wit, an interest not for an individual or individuals, all, but for the idea, for man. And you do not notice that you, too, are enthusiastic only for your idea of liberty? And further, do you not notice that your disinterestedness is again, like religious disinterestedness, a heavenly interestedness? Certainly, benefit to the individual leaves you cold, and abstractly you could cry, fiat libertas, pereat mundus. You do not take thought for the coming day, either, and take no serious care for the individual's wants, anyhow, not for your own comfort, nor for that of the rest. But you make nothing of all this because you are a dreamer. Do you suppose the humane liberal will be so liberal as to aver that everything possible to man is human? On the contrary, he does not, indeed, share the Philistine's moral prejudice about the strumpet, but that this woman turns her body into a money-getting machine makes her despicable to him as human being. His judgment is, the strumpet is not a human being, or, so far as a woman is a strumpet, so far is she unhuman, dehumanized. Further, the Jew, the Christian, the privileged person, the theologian, etc., is not a human being. So far as you are a Jew, etc., you are not a human being. Again, the imperious postulate, cast from you everything peculiar, criticize it away. Be not a Jew, not a Christian, but be a human being, nothing but a human being. Assert your humanity against every restrictive specification. Make yourself, by means of it, a human being, and free from those limits. Make yourself a free man. Recognize humanity as your all-determining essence. I say, you are indeed more than a Jew, more than a Christian, etc., but you are also more than a human being. Those are all ideas, but you are corporeal. Do you suppose, then, that you can ever become a human being as such? Do you suppose our posterity will find no prejudices and limits to clear away, for which our powers were not sufficient? Or do you perhaps think that in your 40th or 50th year you have come so far that the following days have nothing more to dissipate in you, and that you are a human being? The men of the future will yet fight their way to many a liberty that we do not even miss. What do you need that later liberty for? If you meant to esteem yourself as nothing before you had become a human being, you would have to wait till the last judgment, till the day when man or humanity shall have attained perfection. But as you will surely die before that, what becomes of your prize of victory? Rather, therefore, invert the case and say to yourself, I am a human being. I do not need to begin by producing the human being in myself, for he belongs to me already, like all my qualities. But, asks the critic, how can one be a Jew and a man at once? In the first place, I answer, one cannot be either a Jew or a man at all, if one and Jew or man are to mean the same. one always reaches beyond those specifications. And let Isaacs be ever so Jewish, a Jew, nothing but a Jew, he cannot be, just because he is this Jew. In the second place, as a Jew, one assuredly cannot be a man, if being a man means being nothing special. But in the third place, and this is the point, I can, as a Jew, be entirely what I can be. From Samuel or Moses and others, you hardly expect that they should have raised themselves above Judaism, although you must say that they were not yet men. They simply were what they could be. Is it otherwise with the Jews of today? Because you have discovered the idea of humanity, does it follow from this that every Jew can become a convert to it? If he can, he does not fail to, and if he fails to, he cannot. What does your demand concern him? What the call to be a man which you address to him? As a universal principle in the human society which the humane liberal promises, nothing special which one or another has is to find recognition. Nothing which bears the character of private is to have value. In this way, the circle of liberalism, which has its good principle in man and human liberty, its bad in the egoist and everything private, its God in the former, its devil in the latter, rounds itself off completely. And if the special or private person lost his value in the state, no personal prerogative, if in the laborers or ragamuffin society special private property is no longer recognized, so in human society everything special or private will be left out of account. And when pure criticism shall have accomplished its arduous task, then it will be known just what we must look upon as private, and what, penetrated with a sense of our nothingness, we must let stand. Because state and society do not suffice for humane liberalism, it negates both, and at the same time retains them. So at one time the cry is that the task of the day is not a political but a social one, and then again the free state is promised for the future. In truth, human society is both the most general state and the most general society. Only against the limited state is it asserted that it makes too much stir about spiritual private interests, people's religious belief, and against limited society that it makes too much of material private interests. Both are to leave private interests to private people, and as human society, concern themselves solely about general human interests. The politicians, thinking to abolish personal will, self-will, or arbitrariness, did not observe that through property our self-will gained a secure place of refuge. The socialists, taking away property too, do not notice that this secures itself a continued existence in self-ownership. Is it only money and goods, then, that are a property, or is every opinion something of mine, something of my own? So every opinion must be abolished or made impersonal. The person is entitled to no opinion, but as self-will was transferred to the state, property to society, so opinion too must be transferred to something general, man with a capital M, and thereby become a general human opinion. If opinion persists, then I have my God. Why, God exists only as my God. He is an opinion, or my faith. And consequently, my faith, my religion, my thoughts, my ideals. Therefore, a general human faith must come into existence, the fanaticism of liberty. For this would be a faith that agreed with the essence of man, and because only man is reasonable, you and I might be very unreasonable, a reasonable faith. As self-will and property become powerless, so must self-ownership or egoism in general. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.